Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Amnesty International has delivered 40 body bags to the organisers of the Rio Olympics, representing the number of people killed in Rio de Janeiro by police in just 1 month.
The Palestinian Authority has announced plans to sue the British state for its role in the creation of Israel and its subsequent crimes against the Palestinian people.
Médecins Sans Frontières this week called for emergency aid to Nigeria for those in immediate danger, warning that without aid, the situation could escalate rapidly.
Spain's Constitutional Court has ruled that legislation towards Catalan independence would be illegal, but that looks unlikely to stop the Catalonian Parliament from pushing on regardless.
Despite many hailing from the US Republican Party, a number of leading neoconservatives have expressed their support for Hillary Clinton's presidential bid.
And can orangutans learn to talk? We might just have the answer. Human rights group Amnesty International have delivered 40 body bags to the organisers of the Rio Olympics. The bags represent the number of people killed in Rio de Janeiro by police in May of this year alone and were displayed in front of the local organising committee for the upcoming Games in a peaceful protest.
Along with the bags, the activists delivered a petition signed by 120,000 people demanding that the police and public security policies respect human rights throughout the Games. Amnesty has been raising concerns about police killings for several months, along with several other organisations around the world. In July of last year, a UNICEF report stated that 28 people under the age of 19 were killed every day in Brazil.
In October last year, the United Nations accused Brazil of killing street children, which, according to Renate Winter, the vice president of the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, was part of efforts to, quote, present a problem-free city to the world.
Joining me on the line now from Boston is Liz Martin, who founded the organisation Brazil Police Watch. Thank you for talking to us, Liz. What exactly is Brazil Police Watch?
So I started Brazil Police Watch in, I think it was 2009, in response to the murder of my nephew, who had been he's an American citizen, white, living in Rio. And in 2007, he was murdered by a policeman in Rio. And my father was a policeman here in the United States his entire career. And when I started to learn about the police in Brazil, I was just appalled at the levels of police violence. And I started the campaign, Don't Kill for Me, Safe Games for All, in anticipation of the World Cup and the Olympics, to try to use it as a vehicle to educate people outside of Brazil about police brutality in Brazil.
Well, police shootings in the U.S. have been very widely reported, especially in recent months. That doesn't seem to be the case so much in Brazil. And yet, I was reading a statistic which said that a young black person is killed every 23 minutes in Brazil. Why do you think that there's been no, or at least less, of an international outcry in the same sense that, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement in the USA has inspired?
I think that Black Lives Matter in the USA has done a wonderful, wonderful job in highlighting the issue of police brutality in the United States. Their efforts at unity and at just drawing attention to not only the acts of violence by the police, but our government's response, the police impunity afterwards, has just been brilliant, appropriate, and just important. And in Brazil, people are making those same efforts, but in Brazil, the government very overtly sanctions the high level of police violence. And at the same time, the other thing that's happening in Brazil is the people that are primarily victims of police violence are living in communities that are being simultaneously terrorized by drug gangs and the police. Mm-hmm. I was on the edge of a favela, Manguinhos, last week, where there were about 20 of us. We had been in the favela, and we were leaving the favela to go to a local high school. And we were standing there just sort of getting organized to cross the street, and a police car drove by, and the cop in the back seat had his arm slung over the door, and he was pointing a rifle at us as he drove by. That's police terror. So the people in Brazil, I mean, the risk that they take every time they protest every time they speak out about the police, the risk that they take is profound and overwhelming.
I guess you've kind of hinted at the answer to my next question already there, but with the Olympic Games coming up next week, do you get a sense that the authorities in Brazil are interested in highlighting this kind of thing?
Oh, my God, no. People, the government of Brazil, I mean, they work very, very hard to blur the issue and to identify police violence as killing criminals. That's very, very much the narrative there, even though the examples, and you don't have to look hard to find them, a 10-year-old child killed sitting on the front steps of his home a few months ago, 5 young boys in a car driving. One of them had just received his first paycheck, and they were out, and the police shot 111 bullets at this car of 5 boys doing nothing but driving down the street. And the government of Brazil, the governor, the mayor, the powers that be, constantly, either tacitly or overtly, sanction this behavior as cleaning up the streets, cleaning up crime.
Liz Martin, thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for paying attention to this cause.
This week, the Palestinian Authority, which is the governing body of the occupied Palestinian territories, announced its plans to sue the British state for its role in the creation of the modern state of Israel and its subsequent crimes against the Palestinian people. Sputnik's Matthew Aitken spoke to the Scottish-Palestinian Solidarity Campaign's Mick Napier earlier today and asked him exactly what the Balfour Declaration was and how historically significant it was.
I think it's enormously significant, and one has to go back to that declaration in order to understand what's happening in Israel-Palestine today. It's noteworthy that the British cabinet signed up to the Balfour Declaration. In the words of the first British Governor-General in Jerusalem, Sir Ronald Storrs, he said, this isn't done for altruistic reasons. He said, he who gives is blessed as much as he who receives. And he said, by supporting Zionism, Britain will obtain, quote-unquote, a loyal little Jewish Ulster in a sea of hostile Arabism. So Britain has a long history of empire, and it was quite clear that the template for Britain supporting the Zionist project, I mean, the Zionists had hawked a project around the Ottoman Porte, the Kaiser, and various other heads of state, but they struck gold with Britain, and it's quite clear that Britain supported them in order to protect the jugular between Britain and the pearl of the Empire India, the Suez Canal, and for very strict strategic realpolitik reasons. So it was very much a clever stroke in defence of empire, and the idea was to set up a settler colonial project whereby the incoming colonists from Europe would dispossess, incur the wrath of the natives, absolutely naturally, at being dispossessed and killed and abused, and therefore the colonists, just like the Ulster colonists, would have to rely upon empire. That bond would be indissoluble. They would have no option but to work on behalf of the British Empire. No matter how much they fretted and disliked the British Empire, they would have no choice but to act in its interests, and that's what it turned out to be.
So Mahmoud Abbas has said that he wants to sue the British state, but what obstacles do you think there are to Palestine actually carrying this through and taking Britain to the international court? And is it really very likely, do you think, that they'll be able to?
Well, the Palestinians have a huge legal victory already under their belt in that the International Criminal Court, I think, 12 years ago, ruled that the Israeli wall was illegal, was a criminal act, and enjoined every subscribing state to the court to take practical steps to have the wall removed and compensation paid to the Palestinians whose lives had been wrecked by that wall. So they won fair square, they won hands down, unambiguous, very clear victory. The end result was that every single country affiliated to the court ignored the decision, ratcheted up arms sales to Israel and ratcheted up the punishment of the legal victors. And the result of that was exactly to the day a year later, Palestinian civil society, issued the call for boycott, divestment and sanctions, saying that states had failed them, They'd won a resounding legal victory and they had to appeal to civil society around the world to step in where states were violating the letter and spirit of that decision. So that's a preamble to say I think the Palestinians could win. It's not inconceivable that they could win. But having won, what's that going to change? Very little, I would have thought.
And just briefly, if you could, in what ways, if any, do you think Britain could atone for the Balfour Declaration today?
Well, David Cameron was asked to make reparations for slavery. And when he went to the Caribbean last year, he said, you know, move on, get over it, don't dwell in the past. The only way would be massive reparations. Britain was the primary agent in the dispossession of the Palestinians, in the smashing of a stable agricultural society, and the turning of that population into refugees and a diaspora that in some places is very successful around the world, but the pain and suffering of the Palestinians has been incalculable. It would need massive reparations. It would need probably Theresa May to crawl on broken glass all the way from here to Tel Aviv in order to show that she was serious about it. But I don't think your listeners should hold their breath.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you very, very much, Mick. That was very informative. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, Médecins Sans Frontières have this week called for emergency aid to Nigeria for those in immediate danger, warning that without the aid, the situation could escalate rapidly. That's in just one moment.
Spain's constitutional court has ruled that legislation towards Catalan independence would be illegal, but that looks unlikely to stop the Catalonian Parliament from pushing on regardless.
And it's a question that's plagued humanity for centuries. Can orangutans learn to talk? We may or may not have the answer later in the show.
Médecins Sans Frontières have this week warned of the large-scale humanitarian disaster in Borno State in the northeast of Nigeria. The international aid charity are calling for the provision of emergency aid for those in immediate danger and warned that without aid, the situation could escalate rapidly. This region of Nigeria has suffered from years of conflict between government forces and Boko Haram, the extremist terrorist organisation which last year pledged allegiance to Daesh and was ranked as the most deadly terrorist organisation in the world in 2015.
Joining me on the line now is Ato Pakindo, a Nigerian National Country Research at the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of London. Ato, Médecins Sans Frontières have highlighted how difficult it is for aid organisations to actually access the people in need due to the Boko Haram insurgencies. Does it look like the situation in Borno State with Boko Haram may actually be overcome in the near future?
It will be overcome certainly sometime in the future, but I mean, it will get worse before it gets better. That is just the fact, because there are so many factors. Apart from the security problem, the Boko Haram situation, there will be massive environmental degradation to such an extent that the land is no longer conducive for cultivation. And you know, Boko Haram has displaced a lot of people, particularly the farmers. And 80% of the people in this area normally depend on the land. There's no government investment, there are no jobs, so they basically depend on the land. So at the moment, we expect that there will be massive reduction in food production, you know, and that is where the help will be needed. And then the other issue is about, even if there are no Boko Haram members, there are still a bit of security problem, because a lot of this land where these people live, there are landmines, there are unexploded bombs that need to be cleared. Even when you want to transport the food items, even if people want to go back and resettle and start cultivating the land again, at the moment the land is not even safe. So even without Boko Haram attacks, the fact that you have landmines, you have unexploded bombs and all that, make it conducive both for the people to cultivate the land, but even at the same time, to transport the food items. So the military really need to be there to clear the place and provide the necessary security. So there are really lots and lots of challenges at the moment.
And the Médecins Sans Frontières have highlighted the Borno State region, stating that it is now at breaking point due to attacks by Boko Haram. Do you think that this is accurate, that it really is the breaking point now for this area?
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to understand that the conflict had been there, even without the emergence of Boko Haram. It is a cross-border region. So a lot of people living running from Chad and Niger may not necessarily be running from Boko Haram. They are already running from the famine and the drought that has already come in due to environmental degradation. And this has been ongoing for a very long time. And it is now being compounded by the Boko Haram conflict. So it is really at the reaching point. And this is also tied to the fact that the oil problem, then the lack of salaries, farmers don't have access to fertilizer and even to money to do mechanized farming. So with the economic recession coming up in Nigeria, that has really added to the whole issue. And it is really, really at the breaking point. I can fully understand that because I travel extensively around the area. It is really at the breaking point.
Atta, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
The Catalonian independence movement has always found itself at odds with the Spanish government in Madrid, but those tensions have escalated considerably following the decision to ignore Spain's constitutional court in its continued pursuit of full independence. The constitutional court ruled that legislating towards independence was unconstitutional, saying that the principle of democracy could not be separate from the constitution.
Madrid has a history of refusing to engage with the independence movement, and it's for that reason that Catalonia's Together for Yes coalition and the smaller far-left Popular Unity candidacy have pushed forward with the legislation, despite protestations from the Spanish government that it is illegal.
Political journalist Jan Ridicoper joins me on the line now to discuss this in a bit more detail. Thanks for talking to us, Jan. Now, obviously, support for independence in Catalonia is quite strong, but given that any moves to legislate in that direction have been deemed unconstitutional, what's the point?
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, it's the Spanish constitution doesn't allow region to get independent, and obviously it doesn't allow the independence referendum either. Mm. But on the other hand, there is a clear democratic will in Catalonia to move in that direction, and clear majority want to have the referendum. So it's not a legal problem. It's more of a political problem. But obviously, it's unconstitutional from the Spanish view. Yes.
And this wouldn't be the first time. I mean, there have been referendums in Catalonia before, have there not?
Yeah, there was in 2014, there was an attempt to hold an official referendum, but Spain kind of prevented it. So it was, in the end, it was unofficial, and clear majority voted in favor of independence, but most of those who were against independence didn't bother to vote because it was unofficial. So, and last year, there were these regional elections last September in Catalonia, which were used as a normal elections were used as a de facto referendum on independence. They didn't produce a clear result, but however, the pro-independence parties got majority in parliament, and they are kind of implementing their electoral manifestos and their plan to move towards independence. And yesterday was a significant step in that transition.
Just finally, do you think then, given that this is unconstitutional, given that it's unlikely to go anywhere, would you agree with the words of the Catalan president when he said that this could bring the region to the gates of independence?
Yeah, what happened yesterday was basically that the Parliament of Catalonia updated and detailed the independence roadmap and declared that if necessary, they will declare independence unilaterally. They will do unilateral moves next year. Basically, the plan is to have a referendum next year in Catalonia and unilaterally, if necessary, and approve new legislation and then move towards electing the Constitutional Assembly and stuff like that.
Jan Ridicoper, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
We came, we saw, he died. They're going to be captured or killed.
Democratic Jewish state between Israel and the United States.
The desert is blooming again, and we can be so proud.
Iran is the largest supporter of terrorism in the world today.
Hillary Clinton there, this year's Democratic nominee for the US presidency, someone who is no stranger to accusations of hawkishness. And now a number of leading neoconservatives have expressed their support for Hillary Clinton's presidential bid, despite many of them hailing from the Republican Party.
Neoconservative leaders such as Robert Kagan, who founded the infamous think tank Project for the New American Century, which fiercely supported the invasion of Iraq for US global military domination, told The Intercept, quote, "I would say all Republican foreign policy policy professionals are anti-Trump. Max Boot, an ardent supporter of the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq and a prominent neoconservative, wrote in the Weekly Standard that, quote, a Trump presidency would represent the death knell of America as a great power, alluding to Trump's stated position of not dragging America into more overseas wars, particularly in the Middle East.
Trump's past comments on foreign policy have run contrary to those of neoconservatives like Boot and Kagan, who advocate for intervention in Syria, something which Republican candidate Donald Trump has been ambivalent about. Trump has said that the US has, quote, bigger problems than Assad, as well as arguing against what he calls nation building.
Earlier today, Sputnik's Matthew Aitken spoke with Dr. Mark McClay, a lecturer in history at Glasgow's Caledonian University.
Dr. McClay, can you just explain for our listeners how neoconservatives differ from traditional conservatives?
Yeah, so the sort of neoconservative label came out of the upheavals of the 1960s and early 1970s in America, whereby a lot of Democrats became disenchanted with what they perceived as their party's sort of dovish foreign policy, which had came out of the Vietnam War and the kind of move towards the sort of the New Left and the whole sort of peace movement. So many Democrats became known as neoconservatives. It was initially sort of an insult that was labelled at them, but then many of them went on to embrace it. The term just sort of means, because it went on to apply to Republicans as well as Democrats, and it's sort of neoconservatives tend to believe that it's America's job to be a great power, to have a willingness to become involved in other countries' affairs if necessary, basically to sort of be the world's policeman.
Why would you say that these people have, who are overwhelmingly Republican, moved away from Donald Trump and towards supporting Hillary Clinton, who's a Democrat?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably two prongs to that. First of all, I mean, the Donald Trump's foreign policy, I mean, he's labelled his approach as America First, which reminds many people of the organisation of the same name in the 1930s, which tried to stop America becoming involved in World War II, basically on sort of isolationist principles, and also sort of had a pro-Nazi sympathy element to it. So Trump is very hazy about what he was actually doing in terms of foreign policy. He talks about pulling back from the rest of the world and focusing on America First, but at the same time, he says he's going to defeat ISIS without actually outlining why, how he would do that. So I think Trump scares these neoconservatives. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton is sort of a known quantity and who's always sort of been more hawkish in her foreign policy compared to, for example, Barack Obama, who neoconservatives have been more suspicious of. They were relatively happy. There was like a piece in the Wall Street Journal, for example, that praised Obama's appointment of Clinton because they knew she sort of subscribed to this active internationalist vision of American power.
So can you at all give us any examples of Hillary Clinton's hawkishness in action, so to speak?
Yeah, well, she was one of the main drivers behind President Obama's decision to get involved in Libya and the overthrow of Gaddafi. And while Obama is kind of, I think he's on record now, or at least his aides have said that that's one of his biggest regrets, getting involved in Libya, because the fallout's been so messy. Hillary Clinton, I don't believe, has actually come out with similar sentiments, believing that the power was justified in that case. And she was also instrumental when she was Secretary of State in bringing lots of countries together to impose very harsh sanctions on Iran. And this obviously is a prelude to what eventually became the Iran nuclear deal when she had left as Secretary of State, and many suspected she might not have been as happy with that deal as Obama and other people of his ilk.
In other words, you're saying that Hillary Clinton's foreign policy position does not differ greatly from prominent neoconservatives like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite put her in their company, but I would say she's sort of somewhere in the middle of between Obama, who has a sort of realistic, his foreign policy is all about don't do stupid stuff, and the sort of the very hawkish Cheney and Rumsfeld, who, you know, I think Clinton's willing to say now that the Iraq war was a mistake, whereas many such as Cheney and Rumsfeld still double down on the fact that, look, we still should have gone into the Iraq despite evidence to the contrary.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
No, it's a pleasure.
Can orangutans learn to talk? Well, this week, scientists at Durham University have been celebrating what they see is a breakthrough in communication, and here's a clip.
Very good.
Good.
I don't want to be a party pooper, Carolyn, but that is not an orangutan talking.
Oh, Jack, it might not sound impressive to you, but it is an orangutan conversing. Scientists have taught an orangutan how to control its voice to develop specific vowel sounds and use them to respond to human prompts. And it's an important breakthrough in understanding the birth of language. On the line now, we have the lead scientist that's been running the study, Dr. Andreano Lamera. Dr. Lamera, how is this different from how we train other animals to communicate, such as making a dog bark for a reward or a Pavlovian dog's behavioural style association?
Well, it is distinct in several ways. Perhaps the first one I would like to point out is the fact that anatomically, what a dog does, a bark, has no parallel to what we do when we are speaking, simply because our lineage is split apart so much. Our anatomy is different. Our coordination is control is different. So there's not really a way that we could link a certain bark to a certain particle in our speech. Whereas when we look at our closest relatives, in this case, the great apes, we can, because the anatomy is so close, we differ in so minuscule ways that we can directly link something that they vocally produce with what we produced. So in this particular case, we were able to see that the vocalization that Brocky was doing had very close affinities to what a human vowel would be in our own species.
Excellent. Well, congratulations with the study, and thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that is all we have time for on this illuminating and orangutan-filled edition of World in Focus.
This is Radio Spoonik in Edinburgh. I'll be back on Monday, but Jack will still be with you tomorrow. Until then,
from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.